You know, something about camp life. Now, Hume Lake is my second favorite place in the world to be. My first place is Glen Eyrie in Colorado. But no matter how nice a camp is, it's always amazing to me that it's still camp. And even the best of camps, there's still some element of camp to it. For example, Michael Coogan and I share a room. And yesterday morning when I took a shower, I was in the right-hand shower, and the water that was coming out of the shower, I don't know, it was hard to describe, and so I just coined a word. It was kind of skanky. It wasn't that it was dirty, but it's just sort of like, it just sort of had a mind of its own. It just kind of went in all kinds of different directions. And I was trying to figure out, well, where's the place where I'm going to get the most water? And I never could find that place. And so when I was done, I came out and told Michael, said, if you don't go in that right shower, try the left one and see. Well, he tried the left one. And apparently, the way as he was describing this, it was worse than the one on the right that was skanky. And so we were talking about this morning. Well, describe this to me. And he said, well, he said, I wanted to take a shower. And when you think about shower, you think about rain shower. You know, you're standing there, you're just kind of like, oh, this is glorious. Well, it wasn't a shower. Well, then was it sort of like rain? You know, like you might need an umbrella or just a hood, but no, it wasn't really rain either. And he said, well, was it sort of like mist? And he said, well, it wasn't even like mist. It was like taking a shower in the fog. And I remember thinking, wow. Now, if you haven't figured this out yet, my mind is crazy. So he was in the shower first. I went back to the right-hand shower with the skanky water. And it seemed like my expectations were driven to new lows in a shower. And I'm standing there. And oh, another thing he said I had a hard time figuring out if I was really going to rinse off. And so I'm in the shower and I'm putting shampoo in my hair. And then I got the little bar soap and was putting soap on. And then I got done, ready for the rinse part. And I thought, I don't think that's going to happen. I think I'm going to walk out there and wear this shampoo this morning. Well, it was white shampoo, and thankfully I have almost white hair, so I don't think anybody will really notice. But when I get out and blow dry my hair, am I going to have chunks of dried shampoo in my hair? And what will happen if I add my hairspray to it? Am I going to create some kind of chemical combustion on my hair? And then I went to dry off and put the deodorant on. And when I put I looked under it, and the mirror was there, and I thought, there's this layer of soap in my armpits. And I thought, why even bother putting on deodorant? And I thought, no, you can't do that. That's not an option. And so I got the deodorant, and I tried to sort of plaster it on. But the soap was so thick, I thought, well, maybe I should just go back and just sort of use my fingernails and sort of claw out the soap. And then I thought, well, no, don't do that. And I thought, okay, well, just take the deodorant and go ahead and plaster it over the soap. But I could hear then the soap laughing at me. Don't you realize how much soap you have put in these armpits? There's not a chance of any sweat breaking through this water barrier that is now under both of your arms. And I thought, just to spite the soap, I added the deodorant on top of it anyway. So now that has nothing to do with our message, but for some odd reason, I enjoyed all of that. Well, last night we looked at the golden treasure. What is the golden treasure? The golden treasure is centrally in Jesus Christ and all that he offers us. Colossians 2:3 says we have the treasure, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge and truth that come out of that. And those are just two of the many treasures that we enjoy. And that treasure is fundamentally experienced relationally. And the metric or the way that we've been drawn into is the wonder of the Trinitarian, the dance of the Trinity. And that they want us to be a part of this and to enjoy the same kind of love. Same, just as, he prayed in John 17, that they enjoy. And we are invited into that over and over and over again. Well, today we're going to take a little bit different look at this. The title of the message is The Golden Pitcher. Now, I want to give you two real-life examples, and I want you to put your thinking cap on and say, what was wrong with Seth? That's the question to think about. So years and years ago, when we were in Texas, we had one car. If you're married and you have a little kid, that's a recipe for a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding and hurt feelings. Now, I have permission to share this story. My wife is an over-the-top extrovert. The kind of extrovert that has 50 best friends, knows everybody, everybody knows her. She's the life of the party, but no one would ever confuse her with being organized. I don't even think she had a calendar back then. Everything was just in her head, and she was flying by the seat of her pants. And for the first 25 years of her life, she somehow made that work. And when she was late to things or forgot stuff, her personality just sort of compensated for it, and everybody loved her in spite of all that. Then she married me. We had numerous conversations the first year of our marriage about the importance sometimes of having that car in my possession in a timely manner. There are sometimes I needed the car, but didn't really need it in a timely manner. Other times, it was really important. Like I was on church staff, and I needed to be at church staff meetings or other meetings I had in church. And in spite of the many conversations we had, my life of the party, free spirit girl, sometimes she would make it back in time, and sometimes she wouldn't. Now, having explained this many times to her, and, well, pleaded is too strong a word, but you get the idea. Sometimes it happened, and sometimes it didn't. And when it didn't, and I really needed that car, as I surveyed the situation, I would start to get irritated, ticked, annoyed, frustrated. And the first year of my marriage, I had to ask her forgiveness for being harsh more often than everything else I asked forgiveness for that first year of marriage combined. This was a perpetual problem that was not going away. One Super Bowl Sunday, we got home from church. She said, Seth, is it okay if I take the car to go shopping? Sure. Would you be back by 1:45? I was going to go to be with my buddies, about an hour of Super Bowl preview, game at 3. She said, great. About 1:35, I realized I don't think she's going to make it home today by 1:45. And 1:40 came, and I thought, I don't think that's going to happen. 1:45 came, no. 1:50, and just like many times before, I was starting to get ticked, annoyed, perturbed, frustrated. It kind of, you know, God, this happens all the time where I am losing this battle. I hate losing. And about 1:52, I heard the car tire screech in the driveway. Now, my girl is not a car screech and the kind of driver. And I peeked through the curtains, and I saw, well, it was a four-door car. I saw doors flying open and bags flying out of the car, and she was hustling to get out, and she's running in. Oh, so I'm so sorry. And I'm just thinking at that point, don't say anything stupid what you're going to have to be harsh for. I mean, ask forgiveness for. Well, a year later, it's Super Bowl Sunday, and we get home from church, and I was going to go to watch Super Bowl with some folks, and I said, could you be home by 2:45? No problem. So she's off. Another hour, I'm thinking. About 2:40, I thought, I don't think she's going to be back by 2:45. About 2:45, she wasn't back, but I wasn't ticked, wasn't perturbed, wasn't annoyed, and actually, I was a little bit kind of happy about this. And 2:50 came, and 2:52, and I think this one was like 2:54. I heard the tires screech in the driveway, peeked through the curtain, doors flying open, bags flying out of the car, running in. So I was so sorry, so sorry. And I'm sitting in my chair, hands behind my back, going, no problema. Now, What's the difference between those two Sundays? Why was one Sunday a problem that continued to eat my lunch sometimes, and on another Sunday was not a problem at all? That's what we're going to talk about today. Part of this has to do with what we call, in the church world, experiencing God. And in this land of which we live today, our current culture, Christianity follows our culture in this way. We assume that experiencing God means feeling close to God. And we just sort of assume that that's supposed to be normative. And that if I'm not feeling close to God, there's something wrong with me. If that's the metric with which we sort of live our life as a Christian, you are going to be one unhappy Christian. That is not the metric. This metric was in spades on the Hume Lake video last night. You heard the junior hires in high school talk about the joys and the fun that they were having, and then some of the cutaways with the testimonies. I've never felt closer to God. Oh, it's great experiencing God. Well, if you've been to camp before, junior high, high school, or college, there is something of that kind of joy in coming to camp. But there are reasons for that. We have worship every morning and every night, every day. We hear a message in the morning. We hear a message at night. Somebody over there cooks our meals. They do our dishes. They prepare our lodging. The hardest thing I've had to do is just remember where the coffee is. None of us have any responsibilities, well, you students especially, don't have any responsibilities up here. Plus, most of the drama that you and I face down the mountain is down the mountain. Difficult people, difficult problems, drama people. There's none of, hardly any of that up here. Of course we're going to feel closer to God. But if you've been at the camp before, you know what's going to happen when we're driving home. There's something in your heart that's just going to sag and sink. And you're going to try to clutch onto what we've enjoyed these few days and the next few days. But knowing that it's sort of like, as Ecclesiastes says, grasping after the wind. What does it mean to experience God? It's one thing to experience God up here. It's another thing to experience God down in the valley, where we are surrounded by drama people, where sometimes we create self-induced drama, and where things just don't go like we wish they would. What is the metric of experiencing God? In my opinion, the top metric is what David talked about and what you're going to hear from me this week. In a nutshell, it's being involved in the great commandment and the great commission. We experience God as we are moving into the lives of people. That is the real metric of experiencing God. God will meet us as we are used by Him to be a part of the lives of other people. Now, if you want an extreme example of this, you remember John the Baptist? The crowd asked Jesus about John the Baptist. Remember what Jesus said? Among women, no one is greater than John. That's quite a tribute. Now, at that moment, you remember where John was? He was in prison. And he was in prison because some nitwit named Herodias wanted his head on a platter. Now, in that little episode there, as Jesus is talking about the greatest nobody greater than John up to this point, God left him in prison. And Jesus didn't do anything about that. And finally, the soldiers came and they took him out of that prison and they took him where there's a chopping block and they cut off his head. Now, the question is, if you were John the Baptist, what does it mean to experience God then? We talked about the full and abundant life. Is it possible to know that you're about to die and being in a prison and still know that this treasure that we talked about last night is still at your disposal and available, even in a situation like that? Okay, well, let's move into our message here, the golden pitcher. And there are a few things I want to say about this. God as first thing pleasure. Uh, Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. First and great commandment. Second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments, the great commandment. High priority items. You want to spend 9 months reading through the Old Testament? It's a good thing to do. The Cliff version is love God as top priority, love other people the way you already love yourself. What are first thing pleasures? These are some examples of first thing pleasures. Can you all see that over here? How's that? Okay. But you may have to put up with, remember, I was going to be a doctor for 3 years. You may, and I actually went to printing because my cursive was so bad. So, first thing, pleasures. Recalling God's grace, truth, his faithfulness, his mercy. We sang about some of these things this morning. That's a first thing pleasure. Another example, you reflected grace and love to somebody. That's a first thing pleasure. That brings pleasure to you. It brings pleasure to God. You gave, you encouraged, you blessed, any of these kinds of verbs to somebody else, that's a first thing pleasure that you legitimately should enjoy and brings pleasure to God. Another example, I washed and waxed my wife's car. That's a good first thing pleasure. I did something that brings me pleasure, not in the doing of it, but when I was done, and was pleasing to God, where God is saying, I saw that. Hey, angels, that's my boy. You see what he did? That matters. Got the trash out on Thursday. Sometimes this seems like the greatest accomplishment of my week. I got the 3 trash cans out on the street. There's a point at which that's a legitimate first thing pleasure. And it brings pleasure to God. I want to honor you, that's capital Y, with God. I want to honor God at work or at school. Generally speaking, the 2 bullet points here are in my responsibilities and relationships. When I'm giving attention to my God-given responsibilities, whether at home or at work, at church, wherever I am, and my relationships, that's a first thing pleasure that I should enjoy and brings pleasure to God. Now, this is the kind of world in which God is trying to move us into. But we are really slow to think. We sort of say, oh, yeah, that's good stuff. That's good stuff, Seth. Yeah, that's good. But what I really need is a whole different set of other things. And this is what I call second thing pleasures. Second thing pleasures. You had a lovely dinner with your wife, with your husband, with your kids, with your roommates, at lunch in just a few minutes. It was really cool. Your child got all A's. That's really cool. You got your dream job after school. That's really cool. Your boyfriend finally proposed. Your girlfriend said yes when you proposed. Or like this one that says, oh, mighty king. This needs a little explanation. Because you remember when I talked about washing the car and waxing it? So a few years ago, it was a very hot summer day in Southern California, and I thought, I'm going to go out and wash Mindy's car. And so I went out and got it washed, and I thought, oh, I guess I should, I'll do the tires and the hubcaps. I probably should just go ahead and wax it. And it was hot. I was sweating. And I got done with that, and I thought, well, you know, my running by the seat of her pants girl, her the inside of her car often looks like a cross between the trash can and a recycle bin. And so I'm thinking, okay, find the trash and put the trash in, and the recycle stuff she might want to look at, put that somewhere. And then I thought, well, I should get some Armor All and do the front. Now, the whole thing took me about 1 hour and 20 minutes or so. And I walked back inside the house, complete dripping sweat. And she's over at the sink in the kitchen, And I don't remember what she was doing, but her back was to me. And I remember coming in and saying, "Hey, sweets, I got your car washed, armrolled, cleaned out." And I'll never forget what she did. She said, she just sort of turned back to me and said, "Oh, thanks." And I'm standing there dripping wet in sweat and your speaker for the rest of the week utters to himself, "Oh, thanks. Oh, thanks." That was kind of the end of that conversation. And I'm sort of left hanging there. Now, what I wish in retrospect, and I'm being a little overdramatic here, but I think in my heart, the desire I was hoping for was something along the lines of, "Oh, Seth, almighty king that I have married. My knight in shining armor, my car was a mess. It was a freak show. And you came to my rescue. Look at the sweat that is profusing from you. Maybe you should have taken a shower at Hume and placed the crown on my head, and we would have bowed to one another in holy awe." Thank yous like that one. Or, "My husband should help out more with the baby." Okay. Now, these are first thing pleasures that God is really interested in us enjoying. But what we tend to do is we give lip service to these things, and where we really live is over here. From my point of view, Bible's point of view, first thing pleasures are the things that fall under the category of "these things are what I really, really need." These things over here are things that I can legitimately desire. And there's nothing wrong with desiring the things on this list as long as they're not out of bounds. But here's what we do. Without knowing it, we say, "Well, there's things on here that maybe Seth thinks they're second thing pleasures, but I think that one I need." And we do it without hardly even knowing it's happening. Until we get angry and perturbed or anxious or discouraged. In other words, in real moment time, I revert back to my pagan lifestyle. I know that God loves me and the treasure and all that, and Jesus died for me. We sang about that, the blood spill on that. But in this moment, as I'm washing the car, I know what to do. I'm going to go in and I'm going to impress my girl. And she's going to lavish this affection and appreciation on me, and she's going to be joyful. Yeah. As I was doing the car, I had no conscious that this was happening. I had no idea that this was going on inside of me until she turned around and said, "Oh, thanks." What was going on inside of me? I had taken a legitimate second thing pleasure and twisted it into a first thing pleasure. I had taken something that was a legitimate desire and made it a need, and now required her to cooperate with that. First thing pleasures, second thing pleasures. Your heart was designed for grace, love, nothing else will do. You are going to find yourself doing this over and over and over again the rest of your life. Second, from love received to love given. This is the second part of the great commandment. The second is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, perhaps, I doubt you've heard this with the teachers in this room that I know of. But if perchance you've not heard this, you might read this and say, love your neighbor as yourself, and you might say, "I just don't love myself. How can I love anybody else if I don't love myself?" And the imagery of which you are using is that you're sort of like this bowl. And if I don't have some love in here that I feel, how can I possibly give any to anybody else? And you sit and you think, well, I'm not experiencing God the way I thought I was supposed to. And there's not that much in there. Maybe the feelings of that. And maybe I don't have anything to give. That is not what he's talking about. Love your neighbor as yourself. What he assumes here is that we already love ourselves way more. We don't even have to think about it. I'll bet you today, unless providentially hindered, every one of us will make sure we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I'll bet that when we're in conversations with people, without even knowing it, we're going to be living out part of our sin nature, which is first me, then you. First me, then you. Instead of the bowl, what we are made for is to be a pitcher. And this is our prop for today. That was a lame toss. Now, there are several lessons about the pitcher. The treasure is the place where I am most looking for first thing pleasure. But that does not mean that God is always going to fill this pitcher the way I want him to. There are going to be times in my life, in your life, where it doesn't feel like there's much water in there at all. And there are redemptive reasons for that. If God filled up the pitcher the way we want him to, we would be like the Old Testament people in the wilderness, carping and complaining because of all the things that God isn't doing. The expectation that I'm always going to feel full is a terrible expectation. Occasionally, it feels that way. You may experience that this week at Hume Lake. That's cool if it happens. When you get back down the valley, you're going to find this is fairly rare. And there are redemptive reasons for it. Because there are times when you realize there's not as much water in here as you wish. Liquid treasure. And what's the redemptive purpose for that? God brings you back to himself. Over and over and over again. Seek me with all of your heart. You will search for me when you seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. Now, however much water is in here, whether it's a lot or a little, whether it feels like a lot or feels like a little, from God's point of view, because the treasure resides in you, every day there is enough water in your pitcher to pour into the lives of people around you. It's not that it feels that way. It's a fact. Jesus Christ lives in you. The treasure is in earthen vessels. Whether we feel that or not, there is always water to pour into other people. We are not bowls. We are pitchers. And God meets us oftentimes as we pick up our pitcher, whether with lost people like David was talking about Sunday night and Monday morning, or in general in marriage, roommates, professors, father, mother, etc. A pitcher. The great commandment and the great commission is where primarily God meets us. We experience God. On the inside of your handout, I want to talk about the difference between needs and desires. There, I am making a distinctive difference between what I'm calling first thing pleasures, and I am calling these needs. This is what we need in reality. Second thing pleasures, for the sake of our discussion, is desires. If you're married and you say to your husband, I just need more of your time, you have taken a second thing pleasure and you've put it on as a first thing pleasure, and now you're going to demand that he come through for you in ways that he can't. It's a legitimate desire for many to turn around and say, oh, Seth, thank you so much. I know it's so hot out there and sweating and I can't tell you. There's nothing wrong with that desire. But at the moment, I was teetering in the moment because part of me wanted it to be a need. Something was going on in my heart. My heart was making a determination without me hardly even knowing it. I was transferring something from a legitimate second thing, pleasure, to what is a need. One of the things that's crazy about us as people, we are still a very self-centered people and will be all our lives. This is part of the recalibration that God is doing every day through a lifetime. And not only when pressed, not only do we know what we need from people, think about your roommate, your mom, your dad, your spouse, kids, other people at Challenge, staff members. We not only know what we think we need, we also know how that need ought to be met. We are thoroughly self-serving people. And God is trying to recalibrate this mess of which, in which we bring this raw material of the flesh to him at our conversion. Luke 14, 26 is a good example of this. If anyone comes to me, Jesus said, does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And again, of course, you know he's speaking in an exaggerated manner to drive home a very important point. He is not comparing what God can do for us and treasure with what other people can do for us. It's not a matter of comparison. This is a contrast. As far as the East is from the West, these are very different avenues, arenas in which we find ourselves. And he said, if you think that you can do this without Jesus, without me being at the head over here, the treasure, you're going to be in for a heap of trouble. You're going to be a misery-making machine for yourself and for the people with whom you live. Now, over here, my top relational priority is Jesus by far. That's where I can expect, I can hope, I can plead, I can ask, God, give me enough of the treasure that you want me to have today, however I feel it or not, to enter my course. And then the gifts, the second thing, pleasures, every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights. It's a gift. These are things. But it's wrong for me to demand these things be put over on this side. You follow this? This is a very important distinction. Now, what you will find if you're aware of what's going on in your heart is that every day we just automatically morph some of these things over here. And we turn God into a vending machine. God, why don't you do something? Why can't my husband help more with the baby? Why can't my wife give more attention to my physical needs? Why can't my roommate honor me that I want to go to sleep in a timely manner? Why does he or she have to keep playing that music? And we take legitimate desires and we sort of assume that they're needs. In Exodus 20, verse 3, God has a word for this. Idolatry. And you and I are idol-making machines. It's amazing the number of things we can turn into idols in any given moment. You shall have no other gods before me. By gods, he means what's really first in my life at any given moment. None of us are probably idolaters in the generic sense. We're Christians. We're Christ followers. But in any given moment, we become functional idolaters. We are trusting somebody else or something else to do for me what only the treasure can. We are giving in to our natural, first me, then you, fleshly nature. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. And worship, as you probably know, doesn't mean we're having a worship service. It means we have elevated something to highest worth. That's the essence of worship. We do that as idolater. We do it as idolaters. We do it as Christians in real time. I, the Lord your God, I'm a jealous God, punishing the children. for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, at the bottom of your handout, this is sort of how we do this. We foolishly take second thing desires on this tripod, and we make them first thing desires, most of the time without even knowing it's happening. And then we turn those first thing desires into first things needs. This is what I need. And needs morph into demands. Matthew 24:12 says, when wickedness is multiplied, most men's love will grow cold. And by wickedness, Jesus didn't mean they're like blatant murder or sex trafficking. Wickedness, everyday wickedness, is simply first me, then you. First me, then you. And what Jesus says is, when we allow that to live, most men's love will grow cold. Cold. Loneliness, a case study. There are two kinds of loneliness. We'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about this in a minute. Let me talk about Solomon first. 1 Kings 11:3, he had 700 wives of royal birth, 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Now, I think about when Solomon married his first wife, something happened in Solomon where at some point he's looking at somebody else and he's thinking, hey, is that somebody more beautiful than the woman I married? Is she more voluptuous? Is she more charming? She got a brighter personality? And at some point it made sense for Solomon to add wife number two, had a ceremony. At some point, he looked at some other woman and compared her with wife number one and number two, and they had sort of lost some of their luster. And he's thinking, hey, but now I'm really in love. Woman number three. Now, that's what King says, is that King's reports, this happened with 700 wives and 300 concubines, 1,000 women. Now, Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon, in my opinion, in real time as a diary. And in verse 2, he says, I also gathered myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, man's delight. So he'd gone from 1 and 2 and 3, and he records many. We don't know how many that was at that time. However, it was a harem. And at that point, I remember when I was a teenager, the idea of a harem was like mesmerizing. Wow, wouldn't that be fantastic? But then in chapter 7, verse 26, that's not the conclusion that Solomon drew. I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner he's taken by her. Now, what's he saying here? He's saying some really profound truth. When he says her heart is snares and net, and her hands are fetters. He's not talking about the beauty of her face or the beauty of her body. He's talking about something that happens relationally. And he describes three different things here. Her heart is snares. It's snares. Now, when I think about this, I think about Proverbs 21:19. Better to live in the desert than with a vexing and contentious woman. And the first part, he says, whose heart is snares, I think about that word vexing. Now, vexing is a word we don't use much, but vexing means simply, no matter what you do, it's never going to really be good enough. Well, yes, we did go out on a date last night, but it had been 2 months since the last time we did that. Yes, you watched the kids so I could get out with some of my friends for coffee, but when I came back, the house was a wreck. Yes, you did get airplane tickets for us, but we're going to be traveling at night when the kids are supposed to be sleeping. Not quite good enough. And he says, man, I had it up to here with that thing, whose heart is snares. We don't want to lose our second thing pleasures here. And then nets. And here I think about fishermen. Fish are swimming along, having a happy day. And suddenly they find out that some moron like me, instead of using a rod and reel, and I've never caught a fish that way, throws out the net and pulls it in, and the fish is trapped. Now, the fish doesn't know this, but the end of life is near. And it's going to be eaten alive. Or not alive. It's going to be eaten by somebody. It's over. And that's the imagery here, he says, of whose hearts are nets. And here I think about Proverbs 21:19. He says, contentious. Contentious. What is a contentious woman? A contentious woman, from a man's point of view, is even when we agree, it still feels like she's arguing with me. Or I like what one comedian says about the trans world. He says, okay, guys, if you want to transition to a woman, that's up to you. You know, good luck with that. But don't tell me you're a woman until you can do womanly things. Like, for example, can you turn a compliment into an argument? Then, when you do that, then I know that you're a woman. Well, that's kind of what he's describing here. That's a picture of contentious, whose hands are fetters. Fetter means like the irons in slavery. Trapped. Here, I think about the demanding spirit that every daughter of Eve ends up having to deal with her husband, or at work if you're single, or with relationships. Verse 27, behold, he says, this is what I found, adding one thing to another to find the sum. With my mind has sought repeatedly, I have not found. He is tremendously confused by all this. It should have worked, he thought, but it didn't. One man among 1,000 I found, which I think he meant his father, David, but a woman among all these I have not found. Not one out of 1,000 was enough to satisfy him. He was trying to take second thing pleasures and make them a first thing pleasure and what he needed. And no matter who he added into his harem, no bueno. Behold, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many devices, and the many devices includes, this is what I really need. And over here are the things that are nice. You know, God, it's Christmas time, and I waited too long to shop. And it's crowded, and I don't think there's a parking place. Would you open a parking place for me? We become misery-making machines on any given day, in any given moment. Well, let's look on the back of the next sheet, loneliness. There are two types of loneliness in the Scriptures. There is a redemptive loneliness, and there is a ungodly loneliness. The loneliness that is redemptive, that should be normative. If you are trying to live more and more on this side of the tripod, first thing pleasures, and you are trying to be a picture to people, what you are going to realize is not many people reciprocate that picture. If you try to do the first you, then me, you're going to find a lot of people won't reciprocate that. And when they don't, there's going to be a sense of loneliness. Something is missed. Something is missing. Something, they don't know me. There's a desire there to be known, and they haven't done that. That is a legitimate loneliness. It is normative, and it has this redemptive purpose. It will drive you back to the treasure. God, I long for something in this world, a fallen world with fallen people, that my fallen world just cannot cooperate that much with me. And if I try to make these people or this person a first thing pleasure, I am a moron. That's a legitimate loneliness. That's normative. That kind of loneliness is not a problem to solve. What's wrong with me? Am I not close to God? If you're pouring water and you're going back to the treasure, this loneliness is normative. Now, there's a second kind of loneliness that is not redemptive. And that is when we take second thing pleasures and we expect people to meet them in a first pleasure way. When we reverse this, first things, pleasures are my needs. Second thing, pleasures, my desires. I can function with these needs met. I can function when these desires are not met. I will be sad when they aren't. I'll be disappointed. Those are good things. Count it all joy, etc. That's what he's talking about, in my opinion, here. And what this is meant to do redemptively is to throw us back in real time to the treasure. Am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God, or am I trying to please men? If we're still trying to please men, I should not be a servant of Christ. Experiencing God, great commission, great commandment, a picture. We're going to watch another clip of Les Miserables. Fantine is the woman you're going to see. She had a woman out of wedlock, and on that day, that was like a death sentence almost. Couldn't get a job, couldn't get a place to live, very difficult. And at one point, she does have a job where Jean Valjean, who's now the mayor of the town of Vigo, he owns this particular factory, and she has a job. Unbeknownst to him, the woman manager of Fantine finds out that she has an illegitimate child, goes to Jean Valjean, and without using a name says, we can't have this in the factory, and he gives permission to fire her. But he doesn't know anything about her. She ends up on the streets, becomes a prostitute. And what the scene you're going to see is where she is arrested by the civil government, Inspector Javert, and is going to be sentenced to the crime. That what started this was some men came by and tried to put snow down her dress, and she reacted. Okay, that's the scene you're going to see. Remember, when you see Jean Valjean, he had hired her and unknowingly had her fired. And watch what he does. All right, let's go to the video. Would you get that light too? Thank you. Oh, it's got an on-off switch. Splendid. All right, final word and then we'll pray. This may be a shock to you, but I'm going to tell you it's normative. 5 to 10 times on average per day, I find this guy expecting a second thing pleasure to do for me what only God can do. 5 to 10 times a day. This is normative. The recalibration, the reformatting of my nature to live more on the treasure side and to live more out of the golden pitcher side is still in process. I'm 71 years old. I've been a Christian 51 years. This stuff is real. If you think, I'm just not getting it, welcome to the club. This is normative. These are not reasons to get discouraged with yourself. It's reasons to marvel at the treasure we've been given, the wonder of grace. Let's pray together. Worship team, you all can come up while I'm praying. Father, we thank you today for the great commandment to love God as highest priority and to love our neighbor as we already love ourselves with a pitcher in hand. And that it's through the great commandment and the great commission that we primarily have the opportunity to experience you. And by experience, we don't mean feeling a certain way or feeling spiritual. Or feeling like we're on top of things. However much water you choose to put in our pitcher is up to you. And wherever there is a drought of water in us, even that is redemptive, to cause us to thirst again and again and again for your living water. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's sing.